I want to tell you this quick story before we start. I may have said it last time because I love to tell the story. I have 8 grandkids. Did I tell you this? I met my wife when she was 12. We got engaged when she was 13. True story. We got married when she was 17. And we had all of our kids by the time she was 21. And so now I have grandkids that are in university. Yes. And I'm only 48. So we've been married 41 years. So I figure that out, right? I'm actually 63 this month. I have 8 grandkids, and they're just, I love grandkids better than kids. I would just skip right to grandkids if I would have known how awesome grandkids are. And one of my grandkids is named Evan, and when Evan was about 7, well, Evan likes to make money. So I've owned 9 businesses, and I think Evan's my only grandkid that actually has an entrepreneur spirit. And so he likes to work for grandma instead of grandpa, because grandma's like a socialist. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. It's a joke in America that you work hard. I mean, you work very, very little for a lot of money. So it's just a joke. But anyway, he likes to work for grandma. And so he comes over one day. And we have 4 acres, and we have a couple horses. And so he comes over and he says, is grandma here? I said, no, she's shopping. Well, I want to make some money. Can I make some money? And I said, okay. And we have a deck that's about probably the size of the stage. And it was false. It was covered with leaves. I said, why don't you sweep the leaves on the deck? He said, okay, I sweep the leaves. Grandma let me sweep leaves too. I said, okay. So I got him a dustpan and a broom. He didn't like the dustpan or the broom. He said, grandma, give me the red dustpan and the red broom. I'm like, all right, whatever. So I finally get him the dustpan and broom that he will sweep with. And he's out sweeping the leaves. And I went out and I was working, cleaning our pool. And about maybe 10 minutes later, he comes out there and he's chasing a butterfly. I said, Evan, did you finish sweeping all the leaves? He said, no, I'd be tired. I said, Evan, Superman doesn't get tired. He goes, but Superman doesn't rake leaves. Such a great story. Has nothing to do with what we're doing, but I just love to tell that story. He's hilarious. Okay, you're gonna ask the questions, and I'm gonna give the answers. Hopefully.
I mean, I think that's okay. What we're doing.
Holy Spirit, help.
Amen. Okay. So thanks for sending in your questions. Just quickly, I'm just gonna say that there's a lot of questions here, and we're just going to answer questions on the subject that we've been talking about today. So I know some of you have texted in some other things, but we're just going to keep it.
We don't really care about the rest of you.
Shh.
Okay,
say things
sorry.
Like that. So we'll get going. So we've got an hour, you say? Okay, great.
3:15.
Chris, loved what you said about city transformation. What strategies have been successful for impacting the community for a small church, e.g. 30 to 40, with no students, without burning members of the church out?
Pray a lot. Next question. You know, the vision, I have this vision that every single church around the world would have one person that their full-time job was dedicated to the city. Now, they may be a volunteer, they may be, you know, somebody in the congregation, but their full-time Their full-time ministry is focusing on the city. Because I think that part of the challenge that we had when I was describing to you our evolution in the whole area of helping our city, I mean, the largest challenge we had is that our city was not being helped without a specific strategy to help our city. I know that sounds kind of crazy. It's like your house doesn't typically get clean if someone doesn't stop and say, let's clean the house, right? So it's like whether you have a little resources or a lot, I love what Pastor Bill said. He says, he said, generosity is not measured by what you have. It's measured by what you have left over when you give. So the woman who gave, you know, 2 cents at the offering that in the temple, Jesus said, you know, drew attention to not what she gave, but what she had left, which was nothing. So I think that when we give what we can to our city, whether it's a little bit, we're a church of 40, or whether we're a church of thousands, when we focus on our city, we're going to make an impact. And the next message I hope I'm going to share in the next session is just talking about ownership of our city. And so I think the key of whether you have 10 people in your church or whether you have thousands, the key is to take the people you have and dedicate them to actually transforming the city. And I was sharing a little story. I was sharing a story just a few minutes ago with some of the leaders. You know, when I walk across the parking lot in our city or down the street and there's garbage blown down the street, I pick it up and put it in the garbage. When I watch somebody else do that, the other day I was walking across the parking lot and an old man picked up a bunch of garbage that was on the parking lot and threw it in a garbage can. I'm like, we're not talking about brain surgery here. We're just talking about caring. And we're talking about caring about our specific city. So if we can get our people to do that, and then maybe strategically caring together and collaboratively, we're going to make a huge difference. And you just have to start somewhere. And I love that God's not a president of presidents. He's King of Kings. So what I love about that is that it doesn't take a majority vote to get God to move. You know, God said to Jeremiah, just find me one person. Just find me a person. If you can find me a person who is honest and trustworthy and just made this list of a person's character, I will hear his prayers and change their city. You know, 12 men turned the world upside down. That's the commentary on the book of Acts. It says, these men who've turned the world upside down have come here. We're talking about 12. So it doesn't take a lot of people to actually change the world. They just have to be dedicated to actually seeing the kingdom come.
Do you think we should band together as churches and give to our council, or would your heart be for us to dream up something different together? I'm really excited and inspired by what you're saying, but I long for it to lead to concrete structural changes, probably at a leadership level across our congregations.
Well, you know, I think it's wonderful when organizations, groups of people, churches, when they collaborate and they build some kind of synergy together. Now, I hope this doesn't sound negative, so I can only speak from my experience. What I find is that it's a little bit like Jonathan and his armor bearer most often, in my opinion. It's like, you know, for 39 days, Israel, you know, was stuck in the trenches, you know, afraid of the enemy armies. I think at that time it was the Philistines or the Amorites or whatever. And one morning, Jonathan got up and said, can the Lord save by many but not by few? And his armor bearer says, whatever's in your heart, just let's do it. And you know this probably the story of Jonathan and his armor bearer. Jonathan said, well, here's what I think. We're down in this valley, and we'll say, hey, we'll make ourselves known. And if they say, come up here, we know the Lord's given them into our hands. But if they say, wait for us, we're coming to you, we better get out of here because we know the Lord's not with us. So Jonathan's armor bearer is like, hey, hey. And they go, hey, come up here. And here they are climbing up a mountain, and Jonathan says to his armor bearer, we got these guys. So the story goes on that they get up there, Jonathan and the armor bearer, they start warring against these, I think it was the Philistines at the time, they start warring against the Philistines, and the enemy army starts to, as you probably remember, starts to retreat. And Jonathan's armor bearer running after them, simultaneously the Israeli army wakes up and they're like, hey, where's Jonathan? They look over the mountain, they see two guys chasing an army, and it says, and then they got inspired. And then it said that the people, the soldiers who defected, they were traitors and defected to the Philistine army. When they saw that Jonathan started winning, they turned around and came back to the Israeli army. And then it says that the people who were hiding in caves because they were afraid of the enemy army, when they saw that Jonathan and his armor bearer had the army on the run, they came out of their caves and they joined the army. So think about this. Jonathan and his armor bearer, they did what everybody else was afraid to do. Two people. The army got inspired. The traitors got inspired. And the people who were fearful all got inspired. And there was a collaboration. But it didn't begin until Jonathan got the enemy on the run. And I often see collaboration more like that. Like when you have a bunch of ideas, nobody wants to help you. When you start getting some momentum, people start joining you. Because most people want to be a part of something that's winning. So what I wouldn't do is I wouldn't relegate our momentum down to what I can get the other churches to do. Like, if you can't get anybody on board, just start it yourself. But do something. And the other thing I would say that, and maybe this is different in your culture, because forgive me, I obviously don't live in this culture. But sometimes when we try to do something together, we have to reduce it down to vanilla. Because, you know, it's like, we want to do this. Well, John's church can't do this because of this doctrine, and Henry's church won't do it because of that, and Mary's church won't do it because of that. And pretty soon you're together doing nothing. And I'd rather do something with one church than do nothing with 20. So I do honestly think that, now I know, I'm not making a theological statement, by the way. I do think practically you have to get momentum before very many people want to be with you. So we started talking about this stuff a long time ago, and I don't think we could get one church wanted to help us. And now we're starting to move collaboratively, not like on the level I'd like to see, but better than we were 12 years ago for sure. Is that helpful? I don't know. Do you find that to be kind of your, is that true of your city too? Like, it's kind of hard to get people to collaborate till you get some kind of momentum. Is it true here too? Because I find that if the more people you get involved in the beginning, I'm talking about in the beginning, the harder it is to actually move forward. You can't get anyone to agree on anything. So I'd rather just get a few people in the room. I say a few, like 5, 6, 7, 10, whatever. Start moving it forward and then add people, because you'll need other gifts, right? Add people as you get momentum. And I'm finding that as we're getting momentum, now we don't have to ask people. They're actually asking us. Hey, can I be part of that team? Hey, can I participate in that? How do I give to that project? And I think that, you know, John Maxwell calls it the big mo. Momentum really is a game changer. But it takes a while to get, takes a lot of energy to push, to get a car moving when you push it. But once it gets rolling, it takes a lot of energy to stop it, you know.
So good.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome. I mean, you pay me to say that.
I know. So. I do. I was thinking that.
I wondered whether there had been any change in the social statistics of Reading since 12 years ago following the changes you have just described.
Yes, well, there has been a lot of change, especially the in our economy. Our economy has improved dramatically. We had something happen in the midst of that 12 years, so we had a realignment in the prison release. So California has imprisoned, I think, as that Americans in general have imprisoned more people than I think any other country in the world. And California is at the top of that. I mean, we have this three strikes rule. Do you know what that means? Like, if a person's, if they've committed two crimes, no matter what they are, if they commit a third crime within a certain amount of time, they actually are put away for a long time. So all of that meant that our jails, our prisons, our jails and prisons were over full. And then suddenly they changed a bunch of the rules because we couldn't fund the prisons. So in the last, I probably won't get the date right, but in the last 7 or 8 years, they let a whole bunch of prisoners out, and a bunch of those ended up in Shasta County, which is our county. So we had a huge spike in crime in the last 6, 7 years that we're having to deal with now. So we, Bethel Church's team, started something called the Safe City Project. We worked on, we studied the social statistics in our city for the 10, I told you that there's 10 economic, no, I'm sorry, not economic, 10 social indicators that they used to determine a healthy city. So there's 8 of them that we were terrible at, and we went after those 8, and we did a statistical study on those, and then asked ourselves, what's the real root causes? We haven't finished that study yet. We've been working on it for more than a year. But we took the crime part to our city, and we said, these are the reasons why those things are happening. And the city is so funny. We call it the Safe City Project. They said, oh, that's good. That's nice that you guys are doing that. But then a month later, they took all of our stuff, all the study that we had. One of the 7 city councilmen took it on his own, put his own title to it, and now he's leading it. And they're the ones who call it the Safe City Project. So we're working on the crime thing right now, and now we're working on the homeless. We have a very wealthy man, again, one of the 2 billionaires that at least we know of that's in our city. He has a passion to get to build a home for every homeless person in our city. So we have a meeting at my house about 3 weeks from now with 7 of us developing these kind of modular, they're kind of like homes. I'd have to show you. But anyway, we have 1,000, about 1,100 homeless people in our city. So anyway, yeah, so we're working on a homeless thing right now. Our crime has risen. Now it's just beginning to flatten out as we're starting to put in some of these things that we're doing. But our economy's improved quite substantially. Lots of things have actually improved. Yes, we're improving.
What don't you tell them about with the Safe City Project, about the TED Talk style presentations that happened at the Civic? Because that's a really amazing process.
Tell a story. My mind's blank.
So there was somebody on staff, I won't mention the name, who basically was close to the mayor at the time. Mm-hmm. And she went to the mayor and she basically said, what are the top issues, problems in the city? And then she got a bunch of people in the church, but really top thinkers. She gathered a kind of a think tank to go away and really look into research from other cities, like what are solutions to those problems. And then... Am I jogging your memory?
Yeah.
Do you want to say the rest? You know it better than me.
No.
Okay.
I know it differently than you.
Okay. Well, if I get the story wrong,
no,
then
it's great.
You have to jump in. But as far as I understand, then she got people in the church and in the community that were really great at presenting, some of them were actors and things like that. And then they gathered a bunch of the city officials, so the police and people like that, and the city councilman in the civic center, and they presented almost TED Talk style. And they had these people that were very good at presenting, actually presenting these solutions, these possible solutions, that we've gone away and we've actually had a look at these issues and we think that this could be a solution. And apparently, didn't they all...
They adopted that.
Yeah.
As the Safe City Project.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly. Really awesome. When I went out to Bethel and I heard that story, I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Somebody once said, if you have a great idea, you don't have to shove it down their throat, they'll steal it. And we have city council people that steal our ideas, put their name on it, and act like it was their idea, when actually most of it was our people. But anyway, I think it's great as long as it happens.
It's great. I agree with so much of what you're saying, but how do we pursue positions of strength and leadership within culture like Daniel without being distracted by love of fame or man's glory? I am so easily seduced by the culture we are called to change.
Well, maybe we'd have a different perspective on what it looks like to receive glory, because I hope this isn't offensive, but Jesus said in John 17, Father, the glory that you gave me, I want to give to them, that they might be one. We often quote Romans 8:28, all things work together for good for those who love God and call according to his purposes. But we often forget the next verse, which says, whom he foreknew, he predestined. Whom he predestined, he called. Whom he called, he justified. And whom he justified, he glorified. Christ in you in the hope of glory, you were actually built for glory. So when the people were following Gideon, and they, they broke the jars and made the shout. They said, for the Lord and for Gideon. See, I think that you were born for glory. I think that you're God's greatest creation. I think that the glory of the creation is actually giving honor to the Creator. So when we say, I'm afraid I'm going to steal God's glory. Well, first of all, you're not that big. And secondly, you were born to carry his glory. You were born to demonstrate his glory. Several years ago, I was doing this prophetic training for a small school of about 40 students. And I thought, well, before I teach them how to prophesy, I should teach them why. So I opened with this statement. And as I did, as I was opening with this statement, the very first statement, I was going to be with them 5 days. This is like my first statement, 5 minutes long. As I was saying what I'm about to share with you, a man walked in who I didn't know and sat down at the other opposite side of the table. And as I was saying that, I said, this is your mission if you should receive it. That you would find the gold that's in the dirt of people's lives. That you would find the greatness in every single person, both Christian and pre-Christian. Because we were made in the image and likeness of God. And when I finished that statement, as I was saying that, a man walked in raised his hand. He has a question. We've been there 5 minutes. He has a question. I said, sir, do you have a question? He said, yes, I believe God is great. Did your brain talk to you? My brain was like, uh-oh, that's not a question. Be careful. Anyway, that's my brain. If you want to know what God sounds like, it sounds like my wife. And so I said, did I say something that made you feel like God wasn't great? He said, you said we were called to find the greatness in every person, both Christian and pre-Christian. I said, yeah, I said that. He said, well, I believe that you're creating a doctrine that actually releases arrogance and pride in people. And we were in this beautiful pastor's lounge, and there was a painting on the wall that was a landscape, a very beautiful landscape painting. I said, sir, let's pretend you're the artist. You painted that painting. He said, okay. I said, so you painted it. He said, I get it. I said, look at that painting. That's the ugliest painting I've ever seen. That is an ugly painting. He's looking at me. I said, now let me ask you a question. Did demeaning the painting glorify the artist? He said, no. I said, well, you didn't paint you. God was the artist. Jesus was the model. And you're the painting. When we're looking at Jesus face to face, Paul said, it's like looking in a mirror. In other words, every time you think bad about you, you're insulting the artist and the model. I'd propose to you that you can't steal the glory of God because it's emanating from you because you're his greatest creation. I don't know another creation that was made in the image and likeness of God. So how can you not be full of glory? Now, I think pride's a different thing. Pride means I forgot who gave it to me. When I forget who gives it to me, in other words, if I go, I'm so amazing because I did it my way. I'm sorry, you're amazing. Your amazingness had nothing to do with your effort. It had everything to do with his creation. But thinking bad about yourself is insulting your creator. So I'd propose to you that, you know, perfectionism is based in fear. But excellence is based in his excellency. How do you not be excellent when you were created by his excellency? So when we're doing great things and people go, that's amazing. I don't have to say, wasn't me, it was Jesus. I go, wasn't that good? It's okay to say thank you. And then when you get home, say, Father, thank you for the work that you've done in my life. So I think false humility is killing us. Let me just say that again. I think false humility is killing us. You're not going to decide. Listen, the only way that presidents are not going to be discipled by little people. You not having confidence in what God's done in you is taking away our ability to lead kings. Because only kings lead kings. And by the way, you're not just a priesthood, you're a royal priesthood. Paul said to the Corinthians, you're already kings. Do you know that you're sitting on a throne? Do you know that Jesus is sitting on the throne of David and not on his own throne? Do you know that in the book of Revelation, the last chapter, that Jesus calls himself the son of David, a human being? Okay. That's an English look, whatever that means right there. I'm simply saying, if you want to disciple nations, you've got to stop thinking bad about yourself. You know, when I walk in the office of a prime minister, I can't think what a worm I am. I don't deserve to be here. I think I've come as an ambassador of another kingdom. I'm here as a son of the king. You might want to know me. My dad actually owns everything. And by the way, he gave me all authority. I'll meet with lots of powerful people. I don't go in there like a worm. It's not going to be helpful for me to feel bad about myself. Listen, I'm not saying I don't have self-esteem troubles, but I better not have it when I get in there. Because, I'm only there. I have no education. So the only reason I'm in there is because Jesus sent me. If I forget that, I don't know what the heck I'm doing in there. And when I sit down with a president or a king or a mayor or a prime minister or anybody like that, and if I remind myself of what I'm not, I am not going to do anything in that room. But when I come in as an ambassador of the king, I'm a mobile home for God. He's always with me. It's as much a privilege for you meeting with me as it is me meeting with you, because we're both made in the image of God. Hello? I probably have something to say. But if I go in there thinking about how bad I am, I carry no glory, I'm a bummer, you're probably doing me a great favor by letting me come in here and just, you know, smelling your feet. I'm not going to change the world with that attitude. So I'm being very serious when I say false humility is stealing the world of making disciples of nations. And we have to get over the fact that we are not little, we are not less than, we are not small, we're actually born to carry the glory of the Lord. We are not stealing it, because you can't steal what he gave you. That's a good word. That's a good word.
That is a good word.
There you go. Keep your job for another day.
He's so mean to me.
Yeah.
Now I've got people to listen to me.
You look so abused, yes.
Why does it need to be either apostolic or pastoral ministry? Why can't it be both? Isn't that more holistic?
Yes, it is. In fact, every apostolic ministry has to have a pastorate. Every apostleship has to have a pastorate, because otherwise you're sending out unhealthy people. What do pastors do? They get you healthy and happy. That's their job. But once you get healthy and happy, apostles are like, what are you doing? Where are you going? What are you changing? Because the world isn't all about me being healthy and happy. The world is about me giving away the kingdom. So I think that every apostleship needs a pastor in it. Otherwise, you're not getting people healthy. And unhealthy people reproduce all other unhealthy people. So I don't think it's... I was just demonstrating two of the fivefold ministry, by the way. I was just simply saying... I'm not saying like it's either this or this. I'm simply saying that in our transition, we have... Boy, I don't mean this in any negative way. It's going to come out sounding negative because it is in my brain, but it's not in my heart. We have exalted pastoral ministry. We call everyone pastors. If you look in the Bible, the New Testament, the word pastor, the actual word, Greek word pastor is mentioned twice. The word shepherd's mentioned seven times. And the word apostle's mentioned like, I don't know how many times, I forget now, 67 times. The point would be the first century church emphasize apostles and prophets. The 21st century church emphasizes pastors. Have you noticed we're not changing the world? It's the emphasis. That's my whole point. I'm not saying pastors are bad and apostles are good. I'm saying apostles transform culture, pastors transform people. We're doing a pretty good job with people. I would say we have a culture problem. And all I'm trying to do is get the emphasis back on, hey, it's not all about you. Right? Good word. Sorry, I'm started preaching. Maybe I should sit up here.
All right.
Above you.
Do you want me to just kneel down there?
Yeah, that would be good.
Do that? Yeah, okay.
That's good.
How have you presented and implemented the strategies and vision you have had for your city to other leaders you know that want to see cultural transformation but are unwilling to change their current strategies or take on new strategies that could make real change?
Well, I don't feel obligated to do anything besides inspire people. So if they're not inspired, then they're not going to invite me. I mean, you're here because you want to be here and you knew the subject when you came. So I'd imagine that you're all, I think it's in the heart of all of us to want to actually make a difference in the world. So, you know, if people, like you said, they don't want to change, I'm like, I don't have 5 seconds for people who don't want to change. I mean, as far as personally I do, but I'm saying as far as like, I'm not going to do, come into my church, I don't want to change. Oh, why would I come to your church? Why would I come to, you know, if you look back, how many know, if you look back long enough, you'll be a monument instead of a movement. So I think that, you know, a man without a vision is a man without a future, and a man without a future will always return to his past. So, you know, I don't have any desire to spend my time working with people who don't want to change, which includes me. And, you know, I'm 63, and I'm as hungry today to learn as I was the day I received Jesus. And to me, that is the ultimate sign of humility, is that we stay hungry. We know we don't know it all. We still want to learn. We're still growing. And I hope when I'm 75 and 85 that I'll still be in that mode. Like, teach me. I want to grow. I want to improve. I want to get better. And so those are the people I want to work with. There's nothing wrong with other people. I just don't want to work with them. No desire to go there.
What advice would you give the church in Bristol as the next 3 steps moving forwards?
Well, you know, you guys just elected a mayor that dedicated the city to God. If you don't think that's a divine opportunity at a Kairos moment, then I don't know how to awaken you. And I said to the leaders privately, there's two cities that I know of in the world, and I'm sure there's more, by the way. There's two cities that I know of in the world that the Lord right now is using as prototypes and models. Not just in their ultimate goal, but in their process. That's Bristol and Reading. Now, I said, there's probably many more. I'm not a part of this. So I'm looking and watching what you're doing in Bristol, and I'm saying, okay, this is a model for how thousands of cities in the next 20 years will make the process between the promise and the palace. And between the palace and the promise, you know, God gives you a promise, like Joseph, you're going to be in the palace. But how many know, between the promise and the palace is also always the process. You know, the palace is a given. It's a divine assignment. You know you're going to get there. But how many know how you get there? You know, Jeremiah 29:11. I don't know if I said this to you in the beginning. I'm so sorry. I've preached so many times in the last few days. But Jeremiah 29:11, that says, I know the plans I have for you. My friend Mark Sharona said that word, Hebrew word plan, is not plan. It's purpose. I know the purpose I have for you. Your purpose is not for calamity, but to give you future and hope. And this is the message that Mark Sharona, he's a brilliant man. His message, in a conference I was at, he preached this message and he said, God doesn't have a plan for your life. He only has a purpose for your life. And he has 500 plans to get you there. And he said, have you ever used a GPS? And when you get off track, it says, recalculating. See, I think that God chooses the destiny and you choose the journey. I don't think that Joseph in the Old Testament had to go to prison to get to the palace, but he was so arrogant God couldn't do anything else. And so, you know, if you humble yourself, then you get exalted. But Joseph had to remind his brothers that he was great and they were not. And God goes, well, we got a little process to go through before you can get to the palace. How many know that if you happen to get around the process to get to the palace, you can't stay there? And by the way, that's the story of King Saul. The people asked for a king. Some people say God never wanted a king. That's not true. God had appointed David to be king forever. So I would say it wasn't that God didn't want a king. It's that God didn't want a king then. The problem is the people asked for a king out of time. And what happened? Saul didn't have a time. Saul didn't go through the process to get to the palace. Saul went through the process while he's in the palace, and he couldn't stay there. So I do, you know, some people say greater levels, greater devils. I say God protects everyone he promotes. Part of the challenge we have is people promote themselves.
It's good a good word. I'm learning. I just want to add on that and say that Chris travels so much around the world to many cities, many countries. So for him to say that about Bristol is a pretty big thing, I would say.
Truth.
How can we create places within our city that people would naturally gather in or be drawn to, and what would that look like?
I don't know what that means. No, I'm not being funny. I don't know what that
so
means.
I guess you were talking earlier about belonging and family, and yeah. I guess it speaks into that, I think.
Well, to me, it begins with I was sharing with the leaders at lunchtime that I believe that the world has moved to cohabiting and moved out of covenant. And I was demonstrating it through the life of Judas. You know, Jesus said for 6 months, 6 months before Jesus was crucified, he intensified the message, one of you will betray me. As we know, they kept saying, who is it? Who is it? Who is it? Now, I'd propose that if Judas couldn't do miracles, like if he had to go potty, the toilet, the loo, every time they were praying for the sick, that they would have known it's got to be Judas. He can't do miracles. But on the night Jesus was betrayed, he said, one of you betray me. Now you'll notice that Jesus has been saying this more frequently towards the end of his life. And they all look at each other and like, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? And Peter turns to John, who's evidently laying on Jesus' breast, and says, ask him if it's me. And you'll notice John doesn't ask him if it's Peter. He says, is it me? And then Jesus said, let's make a covenant. And when Jesus says, let's make a covenant, Judas now gets up and leaves. And they all think he's going to give an offering to someone, right? Jesus said, whatever you do, do it quickly. And then that night, he betrays Jesus in the garden. You remember how he betrayed him? With a kiss. Because the Judas spirit always wants intimacy without covenant. And I would propose to you that we live in a world that cohabits. You know the difference between cohabiting and marriage? Cohabiting says, I'm in this for what I can get. And in America, we have people with 3 and 4 kids that they've had 3 kids together. And you say, why didn't you get married? They're like, oh, it's just a piece of paper. I'm like, if it's a piece of paper, why don't you sign it? I'll tell you why you don't sign it. Because that piece of paper metaphorically says, I'll be with you forever. But when you cohabit, you use the fear of abandonment to get your partner to do what you want them to do. So you don't want to tell your partner, I'll be here forever, because you use the fear of abandonment to manipulate them to get what you want. But in a marriage, how many know that a marriage is a death march to a life camp? In marriage, I've come to lay my life down. I've come to lay my life down for you. No greater love does any man have than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. And so when I marry, I'm not coming so that I can come to get, I've come to give. That's a marriage. And the way a beautiful marriage works is I lay down my life for my wife.
Good one! Freudian slip there.
I lay down my wife for my life. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his friend for his life. That's what most people do. I lay down my life for my wife, and she lays down her life for me. That's a marriage. I don't look out for my life, she looks out for mine. She doesn't have to look out for her life because I look out for hers. That's the beauty of not just marrying, but merging. Now we talk about the church. The church is the bride of Christ. How did the bride happen? Not in a conference, in a covenant. It's quiet in here. And I'm saying, I don't think people belong. I'm back to the belong. I don't think people belong because they live in an orphanage instead of in a family. And people come to consume. They come to church to consume instead of to contribute. And I'm saying the whole foundation of what we call the body needs to shift so that we come in covenant as brothers and sisters, as fathers and mothers, and we say, I'm here to lay down my life. Where can I help? And I'm not here as long as you treat me well. I'm here. I'm in covenant. I'm here to work out our relationship. And I'm here to build a family. I think that when children are born in cohabiting, they by nature are insecure. And by the way, I think that a lot of things that are happening in our culture, from sexual identity, which I won't say any more about, I think it's coming from a lack of belonging, a lack of fatherhood and motherhood. I think that gender issues that we're seeing all over the world, in my mind, it's the ultimate identity crisis. And I hope this isn't offensive, but your dad gives you your identity. And when you don't have a dad, when dads are absent, and I'm talking about in society, not just in a home, you have all kinds of crazy identities that spring up in the lack of, my dad tells me who I am. Anyway, that's my opinion. Did I answer the question, or did I just preach on something I wanted to say?
I have no idea. Okay. You lost me a while ago. No, I'm kidding. That was great.
If we're going to create a place where people belong, it has to be a place where people are accepted no matter how they behave. That's my point. That's called a family.
Yeah. It's good.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. At a global conference on city transformation in New York, Bill Hybels said, one of the two greatest challenges facing the church is race. How can the church be intentional about cultural transformation in this area?
About race?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he's probably speaking into something that I haven't thought through, but I understand that race is an issue. But in my mind, it's like it doesn't matter what color your skin is. You're part of the You're a son or daughter of God, no matter what, where you come from, what color your skin is, what your ethnic group is. In our country, and I'm sure yours too, of course we had slavery and we had the oppression of black people. We had the oppression of the Native Americans. And actually in our country, most people don't know, we also had the oppression of the Chinese who came to build our railways and so on and so forth. And it's sad. And you can only say you're sorry so long before you have to actually change the way you behave. So I've been to more Native American, let's ask the Native Americans to forgive us, than I want to count. And I'm like, okay, we've asked 20 times. Can we actually behave now as if we've been forgiven and move on? And so in our city, in our city, I started to tell you, there's a tribe called the Wintun tribe that owned the land before the colonizers came, and they killed off a lot of the Wintun people. The bottom line is this. We started giving to the Wintun tribe 15 years ago to honor them. So it's one thing to say, forgive us. It's another thing to say, how do we help you rebuild your tribe? And so we have to do things to help. And the African Americans in our country have been oppressed for, as you know, 150 years. And so it was really, on one way, great for us to see a black man become president in our country. In my mind, it was a sign of the times. It was God exalting a group that has been pressed down. So we have a long ways to go. The only challenge I have when it comes to anything like this is, like, I'm really good, like, let's reconcile, but then let's actually bring forth fruit of repentance and not just keep talking about what my fathers did, what my forefather did, what my great-great-grandfather did. I didn't do that. I'm sorry they did that. Maybe I would have made the same decision, but I make a decision to be colorblind because I really am. And so I don't want to be blamed for something I didn't do, and I'll do the best to make up for what my great-grandfather did, but can we move on from that on both sides of all race issues? And somehow I feel like in America we get stuck saying we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry. And on both sides, everybody's bringing up, well, this is what you guys did. Well, I didn't actually do that. I wasn't there. I didn't actually kill the Native Americans. I'm sorry. I might have done it if I was there. I don't know. But I didn't do that. And so I can only do so much to say I'm sorry. And from here on, what I can do is not behave like that. So that's what I think. I hope that was okay.
That's great. You've spoken a lot on transforming cities. Do you think God tends to work at the city level, or does he have specific visions for certain parts of a city? What about towns and villages? Do they come under the nearest city, or would they have their own destinies?
Oh, those are great questions. I haven't thought through those. I wouldn't have an intelligent thing to say about that. I don't honestly know. I'll say this, you know, we know that in the first century, there was only one church per city. So it was synonymous, like the church was the city was the church. So you read the book of Revelation, to the church at Ephesus, to the church at Laodicea, to the church. It was one church in one city. So a very different culture, right? So now we have several churches in a city and villages. I to be honest, I don't want to give an answer to something I haven't thought through. I don't know the answer to that question.
How should you approach city ownership when you may not be in a city for the long term, i.e. an international student on a limited visa or something like that?
Well, you know, we have the same situation with 960 students this year, international students in our city. And I would say 95% of all of our student population, which this year would be 2,401 students, 95% of them would not be from our city. But here's the deal. Jesus said, He said, if you're not a good steward of what someone else is, who's going to give you what's your own? So I think, you know, and I tell our young people, I say, how would you like to own a house? They're like, yes, I'd like to own a house. I said, then do what you can for the rental. Because if you take care of what is someone else's, God will give you your own. If you help someone else take care of their city, God will count that to your city. I was thinking about the 2.5 tribes that, when Moses parted out the land, I'm sorry, it was actually Joshua who actually divided the land up, the promised land up, when they crossed over the Jordan River. But Moses began the plan. You'd have to read through it. It's a little kind of a little bit complicated. But when Moses was trying to take the people in the promised land, we know Joshua was the one who actually did. 2.5 of the tribes, they wanted to settle in a land that was on the wilderness side of the river, which was a problem because the promised land was actually, according to God, on the other side of the river. But the people, the 2.5 tribes were farmers, and the very best farmland was actually on the opposite side of the Jordan River, which wasn't technically the promised land. And so they came to Moses and they go, hey, we love this promised land idea, but here's our problem. We actually like this land. And Moses said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll let you take this land as your promised land, even though it's not in the geographic area that God promised us, providing you go in first and help your brothers get theirs. And if you help your brothers get yours, then I'll let you come back. Go back to the other side of the river and settle your land. So I think, you know, when you're in someone else's land, like, it's such a blessing that you can help somebody else take their land. And I believe it accelerates your ability to get your own. Did that make sense? Yes.
You
this
right?
thing's pulling this off my head. Yeah. No, I'm bad. Okay, go ahead.
Knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself for your 30s? I mean, that was just last week, right?
Have grandkids, not kids. I don't know. I'm learning, man. When I was 30, I didn't know much. I mean, some of the things I've learned in my life is be patient, don't give up, keep trying. I've always been super ambitious, and as I've gotten older, I'm like, you know, my mom used to say this to me as a 12, 13, 14, and through my teens. She repeated this to me probably, I would say, 3 times a week. Rome wasn't built in a day. So I look back over my mom's saying, and I must have been a person who wasn't patient, because I was always like, it has to happen now. And now that I'm older, I'm like, you know what? Great things sometimes take a lot longer than you think to get done. And you just have to, like, be patient with the journey. And I'll tell you one thing I've really learned, and I bet you most of the people who are around my age, the journey is actually as fun as the destination if you'll actually just find God in every day. And sometimes you're like, man, when our children are gone, we're going to really have a life. When we pay off our house, when my education... And I find that a lot of people are spend their whole life waiting for life to start. And we actually miss the daily life we have on the journey with God. And I would say the journey is as fun as the destination. So I would say to my former self, like, chillax. Find God in every day. There isn't one day better than another. If you live for God every day and you invite Him into your life, the journey is as fun as the actual destination. And so I think those are kind of things I would say to myself, and I do remind myself of those.
It's very good.
Thank you.
Do you have experience of what you're talking about here in the developing world, and would you see it happening?
Yeah, I've worked a lot in Africa and mostly in Mozambique. I don't know if anyone would know Heidi Baker. I was on Heidi Baker's board for 7 years. I count her as one of my very best friends in life. So when I say I have had experience, I've had experience like watching Heidi do it. And if you guys have been to Mozambique, you know that Heidi is not, she's planted over 10,000 churches, but she has a real heart for transformation. And she was doing transformation before transformation was popular. So, she's doing a wonderful job. There are lots of people in Africa doing a wonderful job, by the way. But, drilling wells, it's amazing. You can drill a well and save a city. And also, I've been connected to Scott. I can't think of his last name right this moment, but it's Charity Water. Have you heard of Charity Water? Another thing, their vision is to put a well in every single village in Africa. And it's really cool because they have this little thing now they put on the well that if you fund a well, you can actually see, you can get on Google Maps, you can see where your well is, and every day you can see how much water it's pumped. It's really cool. So it has a GPS on the well, and now it has a pump meter on there. So these are, you know, when you drill a well in Africa, for anyone who's worked, I'm talking about the poor of Africa, you change a city. I mean, the fetching of water and the purity of water is like the core lifeblood of a village. And what we don't think about, I mean, people spend their, I mean, they spend 8 hours a day just fetching water. So when you put a well right in a village, it absolutely transforms the village and it opens the door for the gospel. So yeah, I see in my mind, and this might just, Heidi might not agree with me, it's much easier to transform an African village than it is an American city. Because it takes a lot less money and people to make a huge difference in a village. And so she's making a difference. A really cool thing, I'll tell you this quick story. I've been taking my grandkids, rotating my grandkids to go to Africa because my grandkids have grown up in prosperity. And I'm like, they need to see that most of the world doesn't live like this. So I take them, and Heidi always takes them out to the bush, which is the jungle. So I took my oldest granddaughter first, then my grandson. We went to the bush, and we were there for just 4 days, which felt like 400 years to me. They didn't have toilets. No loos. Oh, my goodness. Okay, anyway. Yeah, how did I cope? Yeah. I'm like, where's the bathroom? They're like, that hole right there. But the really cool thing is we went to three different African villages and we met with the king of the village. And one thing, and these are not Christian villages. So Heidi has developed this way to reach the villages by honoring the kings. So she brings presents to the kings. And we have to sit lower than the kings. So we met with three kings. And so the kings are like, they're only like 4'8". So here I am, and Heidi goes, whatever happens, sit lower than the king. I'm like, I'm having a hard time sitting lower than the king. Because the king's sitting on a rock, and I'm still taller than he is. So I'm on the ground. It's like 110 degrees, and I'm like trying to keep my head below the king. And all of those villages, well, we were there for just 4 days. They all said, none of them were Christian villages. Several people came to Christ, deaf ears, lots of deaf ears and blind eyes open. The chief had, his wife was blind in one eye, and the king, his wife was deaf in both ears, and both of them got healed. So before we left in 4 days, they gave us land and permission to build churches in all those villages. And it happened by honoring the king, who wasn't a believer, who's both the chief and the king's wife got saved. So I thought, that's a great pattern. Like, honor is an expression of the kingdom, right? But I just remember it because I sat for 2.5 hours on the ground, sweating to death, and afraid that my head would come up above the king's. It's so funny.
I can imagine you would have loved that.
Oh, it was. My grandson thought it was great.
Okay. Bristol has an incredible spiritual heritage, and there have been many prophetic words over the city. Is there any word that you have for Bristol?
Read your Bible. No, I do. I think I gave part of it actually already. I believe that Bristol's a model for the world. I believe that God has prototype cities. I'm probably going to give away my message tonight, part of my message, but Abraham was looking for a city who had foundations. Abraham was looking for a city who had foundations and whose builder and maker was God. The word foundations in the Greek there starts with T-H-E-M-E and then it has L-O-E or something at the end of it. In other words, the Greek word for foundations comes from the word theme. Abraham was looking for a city that had a God theme. and whose builder and maker was God. I call those apostolic cities. They're cities, like if you look at Ephesus, you know, the seven churches that God spoke to, God didn't just speak to the church, he actually spoke to the city. Really cool too, did you notice that? Is that me? Is that working now? Did you notice that, okay, I'm going to come back to that, so you're probably going to have a hard time following me if you think these two things are related. They are, but not exactly. Did you notice that the Apostle John, Jesus, gave John a word in the book of Revelation? Are you following me now? Okay. Did you notice that the word that John got, he said, write to the angel at Ephesus. Write to the angel of Philadelphia. Did you notice that the letter that John got from Jesus was not a letter to the pastor? It was a letter to the angel over the city? Did you get what I just said? I'm saying apostolic cities have angels who carry out the mission of heaven. A theme. Abraham was looking for a city that had a God theme. This is a city that has a God theme. That's a good word.
That's a great place for us to finish for this session. So, to hand over to Paul. Chris, thank you so much. That was amazing.